You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to the Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia, courtesy of the Community Radio Network. This program is streaming live from the studios of 3CR in Melbourne. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. My name's Joseph Toscano. Anarchism, anarchos, without rulers. It's about creating a society without rulers, not without rules. What gives the buffoon in Washington and the dictators in China and Russia the ability to determine the lives of billions of people and their corporate allies? Inequalities in power and wealth. That's right, inequalities in power and wealth. So the anarchist struggle is the struggle to devolve power, possibly through direct democratic means, the struggle to hold wealth in common and use it for the common good. Nothing radical about that. Using the planet's resources to look after the planet, the animals, and believe it or not, you and me and our descendants and our friends. So nothing radical about trying to create a society without rulers. Now, I'm a little bit perplexed. I'm very worried about the Liberal and the National Party. And I'm also worried about the Australian Labor Party and everybody else, obviously. But I say to myself, in that old song from, a quarter of a century ago, "Don't worry, be happy." Well, I just can't be happy. And I'll tell you why. Now, we have the National Party, which is now rejected. It's the net zero by 2050, options. And obviously we have the Liberal Party, which is tearing itself apart, trying to determine whether they will follow the National Party policy. Now, they are in bed with some very, very good people. The buffoon in Washington believes the climate emergency is a hoax. And obviously many people in this country, not just people in positions of power, believe that the climate emergency is a hoax. Now obviously many people have been looking at this for a number of decades, and we've seen tens of thousands of scientific and non-scientific reports looking at the issue. Now, why are there so many people willing to believe, and the key word is belief, despite factual evidence, that the climate emergency is a hoax, that somehow it's some type of swindle? It's fascinating. But what's worrying is those people in authority who believe it's a hoax. And we have reached the same We've had the same debate now in this country for over 15 years about whether the climate emergency is real or not. Now, obviously, there are people in the know, and I'm not talking about scientists, but what I'm talking about is the insurance industry. Now, the insurance industry is there to make a buck. They bet that nothing is going to happen to your property. And in the majority of cases, whether you rent or you own or you're buying, nothing will happen to your property. But if something happens to your property, then they've got to pay out. All right? It's a little bit like putting some money on the Melbourne Cup and, picking the winner. Now, the insurance industry is very concerned about the climate emergency because they understand that it's real because of the impact it's having on their bottom line. And the fact there's an increasing number of people in this country who live in places that are basically uninsurable. We're talking about premiums, annual premiums of $20,000 to $30,000 in a number of cases. And work that's been recently released publicly highlights that the number of Australians, especially living in coastal communities, who face diabolical consequences if carbon dioxide emissions aren't abated. But we have the major government in waiting, now saying that they're concerned about increasing energy prices as the transition occurs. Two things they'll raise over and over again. Loss of power, which obviously in a digital age is fundamental to people's day-to-day lives, and the increasing energy costs. So what has the Australian Labor Party, the government, currently done about it? Now, when we started this debate many, 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 many decades ago, in the 70s, we talked about self-managed energy systems, and in many regards, rooftop solar is about self-managed energy systems. But what we've seen in the last 20 years is the corporatisation of the alternative energy industry, courtesy of billions of dollars of government grants to private companies to set up mechanisms, whether it's hydroelectricity, whether it's solar, whether it's wind, alternatives to the coal, gas, fuel, you know, nexus that we currently have. So the fact is, government has, to a significant degree, washed its hands of the responsibility to create the energy networks that are necessary in a post-climate emergency world, or to create a situation where the impact on the planet and humanity is much, much less than it will be. So why do we find ourselves in this position that we have allowed the private sector, with taxpayers' money, to dominate alternative energy production? Now, there are some small communities around Australia who have self-managed energy systems which they own and control. Very few in number, but they've proven that can be done. Why don't we see taxpayers' money going into the building of solar farms and wind farms and hydroelectric projects which are owned by the state? Now, let's not forget that 30 years ago, energy was considered an essential service, and most energy producing elements in the society were publicly owned. But today, energy production, energy distribution has been put in the hands of a number of private sector entities. And that's why we find ourselves in a situation where costs for individual consumers are increasing dramatically. And the issue of power outages becomes a real issue as the economy transforms from one that's coal and gas driven to one that's solar and wind and water driven. And the essential thing that everybody leaves out of the debate, apart from you and me, obviously, is the fact that the state has refused to bankroll community initiatives to create self-managed and owned energy systems, and has allowed the private sector, the same people which dominate the coal and gas industry, to dominate alternative energy networks. It's crazy. Instead of, you know, the government saying that some people on the East Coast and maybe South Australia will be able to get 3 hours of free energy between, 12 and 3 when the majority of people aren't home, and somehow this is going to solve the issue. Well, it's not going to solve the issue. The issue regarding costs is directly related to the privatisation of essential services and infrastructure which is required to create an energy system which provides the essential elements that are required. It's just extraordinary. It really is. I know I keep talking about this week after week. You look at the childcare sector, you look at the aged care sector, you look at the healthcare sector, you look at, public-private partnerships. You look at all these things and you realise very quickly, exceptionally quickly, how privatisation, to a significant degree, one, has not decreased prices, although we theoretically have competition. Two, the mechanisms should be created by various governments to control these private entities don't have the power or the resources to actually do their job, and that's part of the privatisation story. And then we have the inability of consumers to put any pressure on these entities. We're told, oh, if you don't like a change, your energy provider, it can be a real pain in the ass to change your energy provider. And more importantly, at the end of the day, the competition that we're told is there is illusory at the best of times. You listen to The Anarchist World this week, broadcast across Australia via the Community Radio Network. This program is streaming live on 3cr.org.au. That's 3cr.org.au. Well, I assume you're rested after the race that stops a nation. Look, I'm not going to talk about animal rights, and I'm not going to talk about gambling today, but I am interested in the concept that a horse race can stop a nation, and at least in parts of Victoria it's a public holiday. And in fact, I remember quite clearly when television first came out, having a little black and white little box in the classroom, and we'd watch the race. I lived in Brisbane then. We'd watch this race in Melbourne, the race that stops a nation. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it, when we talk about the role that sport plays in Australian society, even corporatised sport. Let's not forget that most sport that's so-called professional is dominated by and owned in many regards by corporate interests. So here we are looking at this phenomenon because it's real. I mean, there were people everywhere yesterday. If you're somewhere in Melbourne, they were looking around for things to do, and obviously they found it. The race that stops a nation. The race that stops a nation. Now, there's many types of races, aren't there? And if you want to use a racing analogy, you see, the great thing about being Australian is the fact that we live in an egalitarian community where everybody has an equal chance to succeed. Look at our Prime Minister. Public housing. Mother on a single parent's benefit. The list goes on and on. He's now Prime Minister of the country. Although he seems to have forgotten where he came from. So, why is there this fascination with these sporting complexes? People like to think that sport breaks down divisions. In many regards, sport actually entrenches divisions. But not against sport. And I'm not talking about animal rights, and I'm not talking about gambling. But I'm talking about the psychology of a nation that is willing to stop to watch a horse race, but not willing to stop to end childhood poverty in this country. Not willing to stop to look at our relationship with First Nations Australians. Not willing to stop as a nation to look at the disaster that privatisation has been over the last four decades. And while we continue to focus on what really isn't that important, we will continue to not be able to force governments to tackle what are real bread and butter issues in this country. I keep saying, and I know you're bored with it, but politics is about repetition, that 26 million people living on a continent shouldn't be facing the problems we face every day as individuals and as communities and as Australians. Every day you go onto social media, turn on a television set, listen to the radio, and if you still read newspapers, read a newspaper. It's the same issues over and over and over again. And we never seem to be able to tackle these issues. And it's very simple. It's about power and wealth. And when power is entrenched in a parliamentary system, which is controlled by people who have acquired wealth by exploiting other people's labour, they control the legislative agenda, nothing ever seems to change. And while we think as a people, as Australians, that a horse race stops the nation, or we keep supporting these idiocies, we will continue not to face the real issues. I'm not saying don't go to a sporting complex, don't place a bet, don't do this, don't do that. But ultimately, these are peripheral to our survival, peripheral to our existence as a community and as a nation. This is the Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia, courtesy of the Community Radio Network. This program is streaming live on 3cr.org.au. Now, I'm broadcasting via a community radio station. And I think most people don't really understand what life was like in this country in the late 60s and early 70s. What next Tuesday, the 11th of November, marks the illegal dismissal of the Whitlam Labor government. Now, the Whitlam Labor government broad reform agenda was driven from below, not only from the ALP branches, by extra parliamentary activists like myself and many other hundreds of thousands of people who demanded changes. And the election of the Whitlam Labor government, Whitlam-led Labor government, in 1972 marked, I think, is 1,157 days, and I could be wrong by a few days, of reform, major reform, which was based not on the creation of wealth, because people understood that wealth was being created in this country, but the redistribution of wealth. Now, the Whitlam-led Labor government went to a double disillusion election in 1974, which allowed it to pass a number of reforms that had been blocked by a Conservative Senate. Let's remember the ALP never had control of the Senate during 72 to 75. So why did the authorities go out of their way to illegally dismiss the Whitlam-led Labor government on the 11th of November 1975, when they knew there was a good chance the Conservatives would be re-elected in a year or so? And why Why? It's very simple. Because of the reforms that were passed. I mean, the Albanese-led Labor government has now been in power longer than the Whitlam-led Labor government was. And they have passed a handful of minuscule reforms. Now, I wouldn't be broadcasting today if the Whitlam-led Labor government hadn't passed legislation to create community radio licences and to fund the extension of a community radio network to act as a buffer against the dominating filth that was being published and broadcast by the Murdoch media. Those of you who talk about law reform, let's not forget that the Law Reform Commission was created by that government. Those of you that talk about equal wages, let's not forget the Whitlam-led Labor government was one of the first governments which looked at feminism as an important part of the development of this country. Let's not forget the Whitlam-led Labor government was responsible for land rights legislation within the Australian Capital Territory, and more so in the Northern Territory, which it was responsible for. The territories came under its bailiwick. Let's not forget that before 1972, that you would have to pay to go to a public hospital, except in Queensland. You would have to pay to go to a public hospital. And the fact that the public hospital system expanded was due to their intervention. Let's not forget the introduction of a single mother's or a single parent's benefit. Before 1972, there was no financial support for single mothers, and that's why so many were forced to put up children for adoption. Let's not forget legal aid. The legal aid centres and legal aid began as an initiative of the Whitlam-led Labor government. Let's not forget that Lionel Murphy raided ASIO in order to get the necessary information required from ASIO, which somehow believed it was independent of government, about Croatian nationalists who were letting bombs off around the east coast of this country. And the list goes on and on and on. But one of the most important elements was the fact that the introduction of Medicare, in those days it was called Medibank, and it took a double disillusioned election where the government combined the Senate vote and the House of Representatives votes to pass the legislation to introduce a universal health care system, insurance system in this country. And those of you that have been concerned regarding out-of-pocket costs for medical care would understand that without the introduction of Medicare, nothing would have changed. And let's not forget the conservative elements in our society, including every major medical organisation in this country in 1974, refused to support the introduction of Medicare. Let's not forget the Whitlam-led Labor government's attempts to nationalise parts of the mining sector. And that's when, you know, the shit hit the fan. No-fault divorce. Implementation of the family court. The list goes on and on. The recognition of the Chinese government. So I could go on and on, but I'm not going to bore you. Those of you who were born at that particular point in time will understand. Healthcare centres, which are now being closed down, you know, community healthcare centres, where what you did is you had a meeting of the community, elect a management group, and you would receive funds to set up a community health centre to try to break the poverty in terms of access to healthcare. We had direct grants to councils. That's right. To councils to do sewerage work, sanitation work, pavement repairs, road repairs in this country's major cities. Let's not forget that in the 70s there were parts of Melbourne CBD, Sydney CBD that didn't even have sewerage. And the list goes on and on. Now, I'm not lauding Mr. Whitlam. What I'm lauding is the people who put pressure on their political representatives to institute a program which was based on the redistribution of wealth. And that's what reform is. It's redistribution of wealth. And obviously they paid the ultimate price. I think there's over 280 reforms within a 1,157-day period. Extraordinary amount of parliamentary work. And that's just the top. Now, obviously, there are deficiencies as far as all governments are concerned. But the important thing is that it was ordinary people who, through working through the ALP branches, or more important, working through extra parliamentary means, which created the pressure which forced Parliament to take account of people's needs. So on the 11th of November, which is next Tuesday, obviously before the next Anarchist World this week, next Tuesday, here in Victoria, we're organising a small gathering or a large gathering. Who knows, he'll turn up. Picnic, bring food, drinks, on the steps of the Victorian Parliament House to celebrate those achievements which were created by people taking direct action in the streets and putting extraordinary pressure on their political representatives to look after their interests, not the interests of that small section of society that owns the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication. All welcome, midday to 3 p.m. Steps of the Victorian Parliament House, bring food and drinks to share, bring a musical instrument. Let's celebrate. Now, we've heard from the, how shall I put it, not the alternative media, but the ugly media. I call them the ugly media. This was the worst government in Australian history. Yes, it was the worst government in Australian history for them. It was the worst government in Australian history for those people who held wealth and power, because their wealth and power was challenged through people power, through direct action. That's why it's the worst government in Australian history, because it didn't suit their political agenda, unlike the current Albanese-led Labor government, which has an extraordinary majority, which continues, you know, to huff and puff and huff and puff and doesn't seem to be capable of dealing with most of the issues that are important to people, because they continue to support the private sector instead of going out on their own. Just extraordinary. So if you're around Melbourne, join us 11th of November, midday to 3 p.m, steps of the Victorian Parliament House, bring food and drinks to share, bring musical instruments. Let's celebrate those gains, because we still enjoy those gains, you know. Introduction of Medicare, now introduction of Medibank, now called Medicare, universal healthcare. Introduction of community health centres, introduction of community legal centres, introduction of, you know, law reform, introduction of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander land rights, and the list goes on and on and on and on. Now, if you're interested in following this up, I did do a YouTube presentation a few months ago on those achievements. And if you go to josephtoscano.nam, josephtoscano.nam, you'll be able to look at that. And irrespective of where you're listening to the Anarchist World this week around Australia, I encourage you to do something on the 11th of November to celebrate that milestone in Australian history. Every other government since Federation has been interested and in creating wealth for a minority. The Whitlam-led Labor government, because of pressure from below, redistributed wealth. You're listening to The Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia via the Community Radio Network. Let's move on.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Now, this Sunday, which is the 9th, a few of us will be gathering at the Murchison Cemetery. No, it's not a late Halloween party. We've done this for about 12, 13 years now. And we're there basically to honour Francesco Fantine. He was a refugee from Mussolini's Italy. He was an anarchist, an atheist, an anti-fascist, an anti-militarist. And he had the unfortunate thing of being an Italian. And if you're an Italian during World War II, over 30,000 were interned. I think it was about 15% of the population. He was interned in a prisoner of war camp down at Camp Loveday in South Australia. And guess what? This anarchist and anti-fascist who'd fought all his life against fascism, a refugee, was placed in a prison camp with all these fascists. And guess what happened? As you'd expect, he was beaten to death. So this occurred on the 16th of November 1942, and we go down there. We start at 10 a.m. It's a chance for us to go into the crypt and have a look at his coffin with his name on it. I mean, there's about 122 people who are interned in this chapel. The chapel was built by Italian migrants in the Shepparton area, and Italians who had died, prisoners of war, in prisoner of war camps, and internees who had died in internment camps, their bodies were taken to Murchison as a final resting place. So on the Sunday nearest, the 11th of November, Armistice Day, Italian government, because this is designated as an Italian war cemetery, holds a ceremony there, which is then followed by a Roman Catholic Mass, and then followed by lunch. So bring food and drinks to share. So we go there to highlight the plight of the civilians who were interned in these camps because of their nationality. With no notice being taken of the fact that people like Francesco Fantine had been a militant anti-fascist for decades. So in terms, we also like to extend this idea to the fact that we hear the drums of war beating. Just listen to the head of ASIO. He loves to tell us how close we are to the, you know, the final, you know, final death wish. And so what are we going to do? Say China is the enemy. Are we going to intern a million Chinese who live in this country because they're Chinese? We did it in World War I. People who'd lived here for decades peacefully, who had no connection with Germany, were interned. We saw it in World War II, when people who had lived here for decades, Italians, Germans, German Jews, were interned. Japanese interned in these internment camps because they were deemed to be a possible threat to Australian society. So internment is not just some historical aberration. The idea of internment is something which is interlinked with the idea of war, civilian internment. So Hopefully there'll be a few of us. I know it's a bit difficult for people to get there, but if you do have some time and you'd like to learn about what's happening, come along, Murchison Cemetery, 10 a.m. We enter the crypt at around 10 a.m. Then we have that. Then there's all these ceremonies, and hopefully we'll be able to march this year under a never again no civilian internment banner. Let's move on. Gaza. Have you noticed a huge change? Have you noticed a huge change in Gaza? Have you noticed? No, I haven't. We still see hundreds of thousands, millions of people living in destitute poverty in a so-called, in a war zone, which is under, you know, they've got a ceasefire currently. We see all this information about bodies which have been returned to Israel, and that's very important as far as their families are concerned. We don't seem to see much about the atrocities that have gone on in Gaza. When you look at the atrocities and the fact that hunger is used as a weapon, it reminds me of what happened in Biafra when Biafra attempted to break away, that's right, break away from Nigeria in the late 60s, where starvation was used as a weapon. But the fact is, we are at the end of the first quarter of the 21st century. And obviously yesterday, when some people in Sydney were a little bit upset, the Israeli companies which were involved in the war effort were flouting their wares in the middle of the Sydney. That's the news, that 12 people were arrested. So what? At least there were people there protesting against what was happening in the CBD, as it happened in Melbourne a year ago when we had an arms fair in the middle of the Melbourne CBD. And the media just went bananas over the fact there were protesters and they were violent. I mean, what's happening in Gaza? Is that violence? Is mass murder violence? Is the murder of 25,000 children violence? Is the total destruction of an area half the size of Melbourne and Sydney, is that violent? Is the denial of food to people, is that violence? Is it mass imprisonment without trial? Is that violent? Is it the denial of the basic necessities? And I'm not talking about, you know, what the coalition talks about, but I'm talking about basic necessities like healthcare. Is that violence? Is the destruction of places of worship, the destruction of essential infrastructure, the destruction of healthcare centres, is that violence? Is the denial of basic medical treatment, is that violence? So let's compare it. Let's compare it. Because the tragedy is that we think there's a ceasefire now in Gaza, that it's all over, that the war criminals and the Israeli cabinet get on with their lives, enjoy their retirement as, you know, faded as heroes. But the thing is, there are people, that's right, there are people in Israel, an increasing number, who are very, very unhappy with the way things have developed in Israel. Now, obviously, people demanded a reaction to the murder of over 1,200 Israelis and the kidnapping of nearly 300. They demanded a reaction. But did they expect their government to go to this extent? Where it's very difficult in many circumstances to look at the strategies they've used and the strategies that were used by the German government during World War II, in terms of trying to contain resistance. I mean, this is a hugely damaging situation for the state of Israel. For years, They've relied on Western guilt, because let's not forget, and this I really need to reiterate this, it wasn't the Palestinians who were responsible for the Holocaust. The people who were responsible for the Holocaust were Europeans. They created the template for what they described as the final solution. One of the most sophisticated European countries became an industrial killing machine. Not just in terms of the number of Jewish people who were murdered in camps, but gypsies, homosexuals, disabled people, prisoners of war, and the list goes on and on. So the Palestinians now pay, are asked to pay the price for Western guilt. And that's what this is about. They're asked to pay that price for our guilt for what occurred during World War II. So let's hope. Let's just hope the ceasefire holds. And more importantly, let's see those entrances opening and food and aid and infrastructure material pouring into Gaza. I don't think it's going to happen, but let's hope. You listen to The Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia by the Community Radio Network. Now, a lot of people are excited now. Obviously, we'll find out in the next few hours or maybe the next few days whether Mr. Mandani has been able to do the impossible and has become mayor of New York City. Now, it's interesting to see the buffoon in Washington react. Well, if the people of New York vote in this so-called democratic socialist, this communist, we are going to deny them funds. That's right. As if they're not denying them funds now with the lockdown, which has now entered its 36 days. You see, you've got to think of the New Deal, Roosevelt's New Deal. Roosevelt understood that in order to gain popular support, what you needed to do is you needed to deal with bread and butter issues. Because ultimately, revolution or reform is not about high-minded theories and ideologies. It's never about that. It's about the situation people find themselves in and why they are in that situation. I mean, the rise of Nazism in Germany was a byproduct of the type of so-called peace that was placed on the German people after World War One. It created the necessary conditions for the rise of a party which used nationalism and socialism as its calling card. They were national socialists. That's what they call themselves. What we see over and over again in human history, whether it's some little village in some far-flung, forgotten place or somewhere else, you know, some huge metropolis like Paris, what we see over and over again as the gap between the rich and the poor grows, and as it grows exponentially. Let's not forget, the royal families of Europe lived unimaginable lifestyles compared to the people they ruled, the majority of the people they ruled. Unimaginable. And we're seeing the same situation occur now in so-called parliamentary democracies around the world. And we see people moving in different directions. We see people moving in a nationalist direction. We've seen this in this country, where it's all about, you know, make Australia great again. And the fact is, the way you make Australia great again is to remove the other from the equation, whether they're original inhabitants, First Nations Australians, whether they're refugees, whether they're migrants, whether they're people of a different gender, different sexuality. if you can remove them from the agenda, somehow life is going to improve for everybody else. And then you have the other side of the coin, which we have not been able to exploit in this country. Because for far too long, people have been drowning in identity politics. For far too long, ideology, not reality, has become the calling card of people who are involved in the struggle to share wealth, share power. And I've kept saying on this program for decades now that we need to go back to basics. It's about bread and butter issues. And that's what Mr. Mandani in New York has been able to do. Whether he becomes mayor or not, what's happening there is a wake-up call that there is another way. We don't have to be involved in movements which center around creating fear and hatred of the other. Because ultimately, whether we like it or not, we are all victims. Not of the other, but we are victims of an economic system and a political system which puts the interests of the few before the interests of the many. Now, when we first started public interest before corporate interest in 2015, we were shocked at how few people understand the concept of the public. The fact that the public is about the many. It's about the welfare of the many in our society. That's what the public is about. And public interest before corporate interests was formed for that very reason. And you can join public interest before corporate interests by going to pibci.net. See, in Australia, because of a lack of taxation revenue, because remember, it is one pot, and there are some people scooping out resources, and there are some people having to duck under barbed wire fences to get, a handful out. And that's the dilemma we face today. And that's the central element of any struggle. And that's what Mr. Mandani and all his supporters, let's not forget he has over 80,000 people who are working as volunteers in the city of New York, to promote his campaign. He talked about bread and butter issues, rent freezes, cost of living, changing the taxation system, issues which reverberate with people trying to survive in an increasingly unequal society. It's all very well to say, well, we've got this committee and that committee and this committee, and you go here and you go there. But the fact is that it doesn't matter where you go, you're pushed aside because the resources are not there. And that's the difference between a government which redistributes wealth and a government which supports those who theoretically create wealth through exploiting the labour of other people. That's the essential difference. And we seem to have forgotten that the way forward is not looking backwards, not being constrained by ideology or previous historical examples, because history marches on irrespective of what we think is the right ideological position to take on a particular issue. And that's why it's extraordinary that concepts like public housing haven't taken off. Concepts like improving the public hospital system hasn't taken off. Improving the public education system hasn't taken off. Improving public infrastructure. Because people think that public somehow is second rate to private. But the fact is, it's public money which is used to provide private services in this country. Public money, which goes billions of dollars, which goes to the aged care sector, the early childhood development sector, alternative energy sector, and the list goes on and on. Because governments have wiped their hands of their primary responsibility. And their primary responsibility is not to protect us from, you know, so-called invasion from China. I remember when we were going to be invaded from China in the 60s. But a government's primary responsibility is to ensure that everybody in this society has access to the essential services that are required not only to survive but to prosper. We can do it. We have the resources. We have the population. We have the education sector. We have many things which other people can't imagine. Those of you who have travelled will understand that. But the fact is, but for far too long, we have allowed governments to rule, that's right, rule for the benefit of that small section of society that owns the means of production, distribution, exchange, communication, not for its citizens and permanent residents. And that's the fundamental problem. See you on the 11th on the steps of the Victorian Parliament House, midday to 3 p.m. to celebrate the 50-year legacy of the Whitlam-led reformist Labor government. Also, don't forget the Murchison thing, but if you go to the webpage, if you want more information about Murchison, Q, small q, 7461, Fantin, fantin.org. You'll get all the information you want. Q7461, Fantine.org. And if you're coming to both events, bring food and drinks to share. And don't forget the public housing vigils every Thursday at the steps of the Victorian Parliament, midday to 1 p.m, followed by lunch. Thank you once again for listening to The Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia via the Community Radio Network. This program has been streaming live on 3cr.org.au. You can leave messages on 0439 395 489. You can actually write letters. I know it's impossible, but write them. Post Office Box 20, Parkville 3052. YouTube channels, josephtoscano.com. YouTube channels, Public Interest Before Corporate Interest. Facebook page, Joseph Toscano. Web page, Public Interest Before Corporate Interests. Anarchistmedia.org, and the list goes on and on and on. Ultimately, the ball's in your court. You can put it in the cupboard and forget about it, or you can pick it up, run out the door, and do something with it. Thank you once again for listening to The Anarchist World This Week on your local community radio station, courtesy of the Community Radio Network. The Anarchist World This Week is podcast, 3cr.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.